Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course, on our podcast. I'm Ady Packham and we are broadcasting worldwide with the help of OldFootballShirts.com. Well, we giveth and we taketh away. It wouldn't be the Albion if we didn't, right? From the dizzying height of a last-minute penalty to take all 3 points from Man United to the spiralling lows of shipping 5 goals against a team that, well, doesn't score goals. I think we all left the Amex on Monday just a little bit shell-shocked, but it was a blip in what has been a magnificent season, and we have the chance to put that right against title-chasing Arsenal on Sunday. And can we totally derail the Gunners? That would be nice. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome the Raw Virgin, a man who, after 20 years at the Metro, has now gone freelance. It's the journalist, Matthew Nash. Matt, lovely to see you, and thanks for joining us finally.
Lovely. Thank you very much. Even though I thought this was a prog rock podcast you were inviting me onto, I'm happy to be here, and good to see you both.
Oh, no, you had to put your keyboards away and your cape.
What did you tell him? Did you tell him it was the Albion Roar or something? Did you actually say that the Albion Roar is actually the name of a prog rock band?
I don't know.
Yeah, but he told me many things. Be.
Yeah. I was led astray and I've ended up here.
But I mean, I wasn't going to mention the fact that you're a Millwall fan, but seeing as you keep going to do this. How was your Sunday?
Sunday was fine. It was Monday that was the problem. But I tried to make myself feel better by coming to see the Albion, who I have an affection for, and that worked out well as well. So it was a great day all round.
It was. Okay, well, let's start with some happier times, which seems like a lifetime ago now. And that was Thursday night at the Amex against Manchester United. And it was actually an absolutely humdinger of a game, I think, Matt.
Yeah, it was a fantastic game, wasn't it? I just feel really sorry for the people that left early because, you know, it was a Thursday night, it was late. A lot of people had left before the end, unfortunately, and they missed one of the great finales, didn't they, really? It was fantastic. And I just sort of felt there was a goal sort of coming, really. It wasn't going to end 0-0. As you know, I had that great run of 0-0 through the pandemic. And that's fully behind me.
There were a few 1-1s, and they're actually mostly 1-1s, actually. But
In the Potter reign. So I sort of felt there was a goal coming, and possibly not in those circumstances, though. It was a bizarre way to end, but fantastic victory for the Albion.
The parallels with the nature of the victory, with the one that Ady keeps going on and on and on about from what, 3 years ago now? With Bruno Fernandes, the parallels are remarkable. The only difference was the referee hadn't boned for full time, but was about to. That's the only difference. Apart from that, we were over 5 minutes. The whistle was about to go. The referee hadn't spotted anything. VAR intervened. It was a silly handball, totally avoidable. And Agent Shaw just did the job for us. And the penalty was dispatched with aplomb. Now, that doesn't tell the story of, as you just said, it doesn't tell the story of the match at all. But there is such a nice parallel symmetry in reverse type thing. I'm not even talking about the penalty shootout, you know, that we were supposed to get, quote, revenge for.
Well, did it feel like revenge, though, Al?
No, not really. No, because if it was the league and we'd been done out of it, then yeah. But the league and the cup, we always have a, even though they're the same teams, the same clubs, the same rules, we as fans have a different mindset that they are kind of on different tracks. And so league and cup don't necessarily affect each other. You can get away with stuff in the league that you can't in the cup and so on. And more to the point, it took us one penalty to beat Manchester United. It took seven to beat us before. So there's an even nicer, sort of sweeter taste to it. Plus, the fact is Manchester United, for crying out loud. That penalty just doesn't tell the story of the match.
Doesn't. And basically, we didn't give it to him. But, the sponsors gave man of the match to Jason Steele. And he did have to make some outstanding saves during that game, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, Jason Steele was absolutely brilliant, wasn't he, on Thursday night? It was a strange one because sort of fresh in the memory still was the victory a year ago, the 4-0 win at the Amex against United, and what a different sort of game this was and how far they've come in that time. But the fact that Albion find a way in games like that still is it's sort of testament to how far Brighton have come under De Zerbi as well. So two managers who've really moved their teams along, I thought, on Thursday night, and a really good, really even contest. But yeah, I'd agree. It didn't sort of feel like revenge as such. It felt like a different, separate entity. But anytime you beat Man United, it's fantastic, isn't it?
Well, look at it, AD. Look at it. We played them three times this season.
And we haven't lost.
Well, they've scored one goal. And how moody was that goal? With bits of handball and offside and pushing and everything thrown in. I mean, as goals go, that was a terrible one to score and concede. But that's the only time they got past us.
Yeah, but Matt, it's a cliche. I know I am cliched, but it's well known that it's a fact that goals change games. And you know, United had an early chance for Anthony. More about him later. but Mitoma really should have opened the scoring early doors, and instead he tried to take De Gea's head off.
Yes, yeah. De Gea sort of collapsed if he'd been shot by a sniper, didn't he? It was one of those that it was near enough to be quite a nasty sort of one, wasn't it, for him? But yeah, I mean, both sides had their chances. How it was 0-0 going into injury time at the end, I'm not really sure. And again, he's not a guy who probably gets loads of credit, but I was very impressed again with Steele, probably a guy I've not seen play a great deal in the past.
But I mean, I do want to talk about the whole De Gea thing there, because I mean, the fact that he was completely and utterly poleaxed. I mean, he was out for quite some time, and they didn't add all the injury time on at the end of the first half. So I'm just wondering whether he added some of that on at the end of the second half. Maybe. I think he probably shouldn't. But that's,
this is where you're going to get someone like Nick Schapanik or Henry Winter. We've had them back on the show. This is where they'll start screaming blue murder about FIFA refusing to introduce the
concussion rules.
because there was certainly an early game in the World Cup where the fella eventually went off, but you know, he went down two or three times. Mm. Now De Gea sort of clearly recovered a lot quicker than that.
Was it?
But if you can have a 10-minute break, just put the next keeper on.
I think it was England v Iran, wasn't it? Where the
it was the Iranian goalkeeper. Yeah.
Yes, you're right. It was.
And he looked to be in a terrible state, and then eventually he comes off. But yeah, there's surely got to be time for change now, hasn't there? You've got to be able to put a temporary sub on, surely, in these situations.
Specifically, well, they can do it in other sports. Rugby's got the blood substitutes and the concussion substitutes, and it's like, and they get to go and have that time to make sure that they're properly okay to continue. Because I mean, you know, it could be life threatening at the end of the day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, very much so.
Yeah. In the end, De Gea played all right. I mean, we didn't really get a chance to test him in the first half. You know, you think, well, sort of throw one up against him, you know, lob it high to see how he is. If he catches it clean, you think, okay, well, it's not worth going down that route of slinging him in. But like I say, for the rest of the game, he seemed okay. But it's a concern. You know, when you see a player that groggy, a keeper that groggy, and like I say, it was the only other thing I'd say about it is, I mean, as a shot goes from Mitoma, the accuracy that he didn't want was absolutely outstanding. Of all the places he was aiming for, the last place was his face, and he managed to actually smack it straight on, more accurately than a coconut shy. In the one place he didn't want to put it, he really should have put the Albion one. The fact that we can actually come back to the fact we've won 1-0 takes away the arguments that we have about the other potential red card incidences and the other squandered chances and so on and so forth. But frankly, you know, in one-on-one situations where I thought we'd been improving, we're making a bit of a pig's ear of it again nowadays.
Certainly so. But I actually certainly think that De Gea may still have been groggy at West Ham on at the weekend. I mean, that
who
was
knows?
That was a terrible one. But yeah, I mean, there were some interesting officiating decisions in this one. I mean, there was certainly one. I think there was an occasion where Matoma was brought down by not one, but two United players. And VAR just didn't seem to think there was enough there.
I've just watched it again now.
And I'm like, well, that's a penalty all day long.
Hang on, which because he went down twice. Are you talking about the one at the north or the south end?
In the north.
Right, I've seen that. It was a dive. I was so annoyed with him when I saw that again. He wasn't touched. He went down under his own steam, and it's something again. He's got to, you know, earlier in the season I was talking about, you know, when he waved the imaginary yellow card.
Mm.
That aspect of his game. All right, it doesn't affect in theory his overall play, but if he's going to go down like that, you know, VAR is going to pick it up. You know, don't get me wrong.
I think he has got a reputation, though, that there a little bit. And Matt, I mean, you'll probably see this hear about this more than we do. But I mean, certain players do have reputations. I know the refs are meant to like take each game as a brand new day, for what it is. But I mean, you know, certain players have got reputations, and you know, if they do go down too easily, they don't necessarily get the decision. It's a classic case of the boy who cried wolf.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there'll be times Matoma goes down, it's completely genuine. There'll be others like that incident you're talking about where it's not. And, you know, things happen so quickly in the game these days and all these sort of things. Referees have that moment, don't they, to make a decision. And if they're thinking that this is a guy who does this all the time, that's definitely going to be part of their decision making, isn't it? It's human nature.
But if that is the case, aren't referees meant to be like punishing this now? I mean, there was the absolute blatant one from Rashford in the first half, where there was nobody even in the same postcode as him, and he went down.
I think you're falling into that ideology again, that if it's not a foul, then it must be a dive. And of course, the answer is no, it's not, because between a foul at one end of the scale and a dive at the other end, there's a whole number of instances that it could be. It could be a slip. It could be a stumble. It could be a coming together that's not a foul. It could be a loss of balance. The referee, in theory, I mean, never mind how we perceive how a referee makes a decision, a referee has to be sure that it's a penalty. Otherwise, he can't give it. But he might think it's probably a penalty, but probably isn't enough to give it.
Yeah, but if a player slips, then fair enough, he slips over. But then to turn around and go, "Ref, I've just been shot!" It's like,
well, yes, but and you know, that's a mindset where it's a mindset that they know they're not going to get punished for it, and they're not going to get retrospectively punished for it. So they'll try it until such time as they do that, and then, if we're talking about them bringing in a whole set of rules and considerations and the things, then we're not that far from refereeing by thought police. So even you're right. The Rashford one was ridiculous. And even from the West Stand, you could see that he went down like a sack of spuds. But the referee, in order to give it, has to know, and I mean know, that it's a dive. We saw afterwards it was a dive, and we thought it was probably a dive, but like I say, probably isn't good enough.
Yeah, there's so much nuance to this, isn't there, as well? Like you say, it's not always cut and dried, and I think this is something that needs to be clamped down on, because it brings us all together in terms of annoyance, I think, in football. Whoever you support, whatever your sort of role in football, that, you know, diving and simulation is something we want to get rid of. So, you know, there needs to be a real proper coming down hard on this as of next season. We keep hearing there's going to be more and more, but doesn't seem to be the case, does it? There's not been that clear directive this year, it feels like.
No. And also, the other point is there was a really good piece in The Athletic in the Times by Henry Winter, where he's talking about what we would call outhousery. Now, outhousery on a certain level as its sense of humour, and it depends on which side you look at it from, but I think they're talking about the amount of time it takes to take a goal kick, and you know, the amount of I think someone works out that in 18 goal kicks that a particular goalkeeper had, and I couldn't tell you which one it isn't Pope from Newcastle, but it took 13 minutes. So that's 13 minutes of the game while the keeper faffs around, takes a drink, wipes his gloves, places the ball, has a look, orders everyone around. And Jordan Pickford is a master of that. I think he was second or third in the list of doing it. 13 minutes are taken up just waiting for a goal kick. And if referees are, or if the football itself is interested in pushing the game along, then these are the things that have to be picked up on. The big one, of course, and it's the one that's been in for 25 years or more, is the 6-second rule. Can either of you remember the last time that was actually adhered to?
No, not at all. And I think, you know, again, you begin to question how much of the game are you actually seeing when you go to see a match, because there's so much of it is taken up with time wasting. Another thing that we'd like to eradicate in the game, surely, but it's not good, is it? You see so much time wasting from goalkeepers, from players in general. And, you know, if they're allowed to get away with it, they'll do it, won't they? They're masters at it. Yeah. Sean Dyche sets his team up really well to do it.
Okay, but Matt, I mean, okay, let's go. I mean, you spent a large chunk of the winter over in Qatar, and over there we were seeing games go to 10, 12, 13 minutes, like time added on at the end of the game, because they were stopping it for all of this outhousery.
Yeah. So over there, during the group stage, it was crazy, wasn't it? You were getting sort of 28 minutes overall added on in a game.
Yeah.
It was something else. And we just don't see that levels domestically, do we? We don't sort of see that much time added on. So they are kind of getting away with it, if you're talking Pickford levels of time wasting.
But to you, did it add a level of satisfaction to the match itself?
What's that? The added on time in the World Cup? No. Not massively, but you sort of felt there was a sense of justice, perhaps, for the team that were on the receiving end of the time wasting. But was there a sense of satisfaction? No.
I was just going to say, because what we're talking about here is the amount of time a ball in play. And again, the stats point out that it's Newcastle are the worst offenders, that on average, the ball is in play for 51 minutes during a Newcastle game. That means there's 39 minutes where it's not. That is appalling. So if you go that extra, like you say, that extra 28 minutes, of which 20 will be in play, 70 minutes, far more appealing. The other point I wanted to make, and I want to put it back to you, AD, is we were talking about all the simulation. Do you think, therefore, that it's about time that IFAB and FIFA and UEFA and the FA and what have you revisited Gordon Smith's old idea of retrospective cards for simulation?
Basically, that's what VAR is, though, isn't it?
I'm talking about after the game. Like, for instance, Rashford's dive. Theoretically, dealt with by the referee at the time because he saw the incident and deemed it not worthy of a yellow card. But if you see it afterwards, because VAR doesn't cover simulation.
Oh, yeah. But when Gordon came up with that directive, I mean, I don't know if you know about this, like Gordon Smith, that Gordon Smith, when he was the chief executive of the Scottish of the Scottish FA, he came up with this directive in Scotland that you could retrospectively punish someone if they were caught diving. Obviously, this was before VAR came in, so there is some sort of logic or directive that they can take from that and maybe come back to it. I mean, we would probably fall foul of it with some of our players from time to time as well.
I'm sure. But my point would be, AD, is because VAR doesn't cover simulation, it covers yes-no penalty. And don't forget, yes-no penalty can easily just cover all those various things that myself and Matt were talking about in the terms of the nuance.
Unless you're Tottenham.
Well, there's always an exception to the rule, yes. But my point would be is that it doesn't cover what Marcus Rashford did. All the referee saw was that's not a penalty. What he'd then see VAR could then turn around and see that was a dive, but it's not what their job is. They can't go to the ref, you need to book him because it's a dive. That's not what their job is.
Okay, well, let's talk about something that was a penalty, and the build-up to that. Obviously, we're at the last knockings of the game. Albion were throwing everything at United, all hands to the pump. It was like...
But they were superb in those last 20 minutes. They were really good, the Albion were, in the last 20 minutes.
Yeah, and they were just
absolutely battered them.
And, you know, there was clearances off the line, there was saves, there was everything. And it was like... And the ref did actually miss the sure handball. I mean, there was so much going on, I'm not surprised he did miss it. But actually, finally, good VAR.
Adie, did you miss it?
At the time, yeah, I missed it, yeah.
Sure. So, yeah, well, the thing is, that's
no,
what
yeah,
VAR's
it was, sure,
for.
You're right, it was, yeah.
I mean, that's in theory, I mean, irrespective of checking badge, that's what it's there for. So, yeah, I mean, but I mean, what can we say to it? He stuck his hand up like in the air. I think what Luke Shaw's problem was, where he's trying to be both recalcitrant and belligerent, was saying that it shouldn't have been a court. Well, if it hadn't been
a free kick leading to the corner.
Well, there's a small matter of the fact that he did actually, yeah. Enciso might have made a bit of a meal of it, but hello, look at your own teammates first before starting chucking stones in your greenhouse. He did clothesline him.
That's not.
I mean, what do you want us to say, Luke? That you can do one thing and we can't.
Yeah,
don't work that way.
Sure. But I mean, there was a lot of outhousery then from United. Obviously, they were trying to do their thing, missing out the penalty spot. But there's one person who was the coolest person in the stadium, and that was Alexis McAllister. He just moved himself away from it and just like did a spot of gardening.
Is this something you witnessed, Matt, at the time?
I thought it was terrific the way he handled it, really. Taking himself out of the situation, taking himself away from all the games. And yeah, it was a sort of masterclass in how to stay cool in the 100th minute of a game with a penalty to win it against Manchester United, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, that is the ultimate, isn't it? You know, Alexis McAllister, brackets pen 99.
Yeah.
It's the only thing that was missing was a flake, wasn't it?
I was going to say it was a bit flaky. but
the point is that, you know, let's face it, there were 30,000, well, probably 25,000, because let's talk about those that went in a minute. The 25,000 squeaky bums in the stadium, some hoping that De Gea would save it. You know, we've got every sense of confidence in McAllister's penalties at the moment. But there's always one that's going to happen, isn't it? And you think, please, not now.
But, well, this is what we liked about De Zerbi, though, wasn't it? I mean, it was like the scenes of Poyet with Dean of not watching.
Yeah, that. Thanks for having the faith in his own players not to do that. You know, if I was the manager, even though I'd hate it, I'd watch it because think, you know, it's if McAllister can take himself out of the situation, so can De Zerbi. Or is that what he was trying to do? Do you think?
I think maybe he was. Maybe he was. I mean, he said he knew the ball had gone in because he could hear the crowd. But I mean, you know,
well, absolutely. It was like,
maybe he's superstitious. Who knows? But I mean, it was an absolute delight, though, and it put us into a really good position going into Monday. But we'll try and avoid that later.
The point is, let's talk about the things that should have happened. And if we're going to talk about VAR, what's wrong with Antony? What's wrong with Casemiro? Are they really that? Have they really got their midfield from Blackpool Beach?
It was incredible,
go on,
wasn't
Matt,
it?
Go on, with a neutral hat on, mildly neutral hat on. Give us your overview of how those two donkeys managed to avoid red cards.
I don't really know is the honest answer. It was a bizarre one. Especially Antony was on our side of the stadium. And you see Antony squaring up to Lewis Dunk and you think, well, first of all, good luck. first of all, you're going to be headbutting him around the sort of belly button region if you're going in with your head. And
Dunk's just going to tread on his satchel.
just bizarre. I don't know how both of them stayed on the pitch, really. And again, you come away with a little sense of injustice. I think we spoke about it briefly even after the game on the concourses about... you know, the big clubs getting these sort of decisions and not the sort of decisions you perhaps get for the rest of the league. You know, you tend to get players get away with these sort of things. Where's VAR when you need it at times? And I don't know how you like to finish with 11. Yeah.
There does appear to be the sainted few. Harry Kane, we're looking at you.
Let's look exactly at what happened. Yeah. I mean, Antony didn't get his free kick because... Well, he's a donkey. He likes to... I mean, you know, Manchester United, you know, they are gravity whores. Let's call them for what they are. They do love the feel of the turf. Didn't get his free kick because it wasn't a free kick. Gets the hump because I play for Man United. How dare you not give me a free kick, you little oik of a linesman. And it's premeditated. Everyone in the stadium could see it coming. You could see him fly into McAllister. Luckily, just goes. He doesn't actually whack his leg, as in full on. He kind of glances it, but it's enough to jolly well smart. So that's that. That's clearly a probable red in its own right because it was premeditated. And then he does his, like you say, his chest butts. Well, chest slash knackers butt against Lewis Dunk, yes. Who, like I say, he just looked like he was going to nick his tuck shop money. Now, if Lewis Dunk got done for that, he got a yellow card for that, then why didn't Anthony get a yellow card for that? So if nothing else, there were two separate incidents by which Anthony could and should have got a yellow card. And let's face it, one of them, he could have got a yellow and a red and a yellow and a red.
Yeah, totally.
Did he play Connect Four?
Yeah. Now, the thing is, I remember about Casemiro, him taking someone down, but I cannot for the life of me recall the second incident where people saying he should have gone. Can you remind me?
Which one was it, though?
Casemiro.
He breathed. That's usually you know what I mean. With all the euphoria, I mean, I've watched it back today, and it's like that wasn't included in the highlights, so I can't. Right. I don't remember. It was.
Is he one of those players that you just press the top of his head and his foot comes out?
Well, he's one of those players. He's actually, he's really helped United season. He is a decent player. I mean, let's be honest here. He is prone to, certain elements of the red mist. I mean, I was watching the Man City Madrid game last night, and obviously he was won a few Champions Leagues with Madrid, and I was watching some of the outhousery going on in that game last night, and it was just like I just couldn't work out quite how this stuff was being allowed, and I guess on the continent a lot of these challenges are allowed, and basically he's just got to get used to the way that officials work in this country, is as long and short of it, really.
Well, how long has he been here?
He came in at the end of August, wasn't it?
Yeah. So this is your first season, is it?
Yeah.
Right. So, tell just how much I care about Man United.
Well, yeah, about as much as I do. So on that note, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course on our podcast. This show is, as ever, brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. Over 130,000 shirts for your delight and for you to devour at your leisure. But Phil has sent us an interesting one for us. I think you both might get this one, actually.
Matt,
do you want to have a go at describing it for me?
Can I just say, before he does, he hasn't photoshopped the badge this time, so you can read it. Go on, Matt. Can you describe this for us?
Yeah, so I've got it. Bear with me, sorry. Okay, so it is an incredible design. It brings back memories of seeing the first time I saw this, thinking, goodness me, I really need to give up drinking.
ironic.
Yeah, it is ironic because it's got Robinson's best bitter plastered across the centre. And this sort of blue and red spiky sort of design in four hoops around the centre of white shirt.
It looks like interference.
It does look like interference. And it's Gola as well, made by Gola. Fantastic old brand. Are Gola still going? Who knows?
I think they are.
It's fantastic. A grand old shirt, the away kit of a very grand old northern club. That is absolutely beautiful, actually. The red and blue spiked interference running around four hoops of the shirt.
So makes you look like you've got bad eyesight.
Yeah, so who do you think it is, Matt?
Stockport County?
Yes, it is. And this is what Phil has to say about this particular jersey. So this is your shirt of the week. And this is the 1992-93 away shirt of current League Two side, Stockport County. I say current, as the Hatters have just secured fourth place in the league and will travel to Salford City in the League Two playoff semi-final on Monday evening next week. Stockport play at the 10,852 capacity Edgeley Park Stadium. The stadium was originally built in 1891 for Stockport Rugby Club, but they went defunct and the football club took it over in 1903. They play continuously in the Football League until 2011 when they dropped into the Conference, and they returned to League Two in 2022. And in the 90s, they played five seasons in the second tier, currently called the Championship, and made it to the League Cup semi-final in 96-97 when they went out 2-1 to Middlesbrough on aggregate. The club hasn't played in mainly blue and white kits, all in different formats, blue with white trim, white with blue trim, striped, pinstriped, blue and white, I can't say that word, Phil, but it comes out of seagulls. blue and white hoops, as well as styles reminiscent of both Birmingham City and Boca Juniors, but in blue and white. Mainly, these you can see on the Stockport page at oldfootballshirts.com. Of course you can, Phil. Notable former players then include Dave Jones, Brett Angel, and the late Keith Alexander. Joel Cantona, the younger brother of Eric, played three times for the side in 93 to 94. And the single most famous former player has to be George Best, who made three league appearances for Stockport in the 75-76 season. If you consider Albion's time in the 90s and early 2000s, it's no surprise that there are plenty of links between Stockport and the Seagulls. But the links do go back a little bit further than that too. Here are a few names who have worn both shirts. Malcolm Poskett, here's one of his 1977 match shirts. Frank Worthington, John Keeley. And then there was Jimmy McNulty, Mark Cartwright, Alan Blaney, Liam Dickinson and James Tunnicliffe. And then the Amex years, you know, Gary Dicker, Gordon Greer, Chris O'Brady, Liam Bridcut. Only one former County player has represented the Albion in the Premier League, though, and that was, of course, Glenn Murray. And a completely up-to-date link, current under-21 midfielder Jack Hinchey began his career at Edgeley Park. So thank you for that, Phil. Of course, you can see that and over 130,000 other shirts over at oldfootballshirts.com. Speaking of shirts, Al, we had a competition last week.
We certainly did. We teamed up with our good friends at Art of Football, who have produced a lovely promotional video for their new range of Matoma streetwear. I know my phrases for being down with the kids. I am the sartorial god of this room. we teamed up with Art of Football, and we are giving away a Kaoru Mitoma t-shirt and a green and black scarf. And what we wanted to know was, from which football club did we acquire the services of Kaoru Mitoma? Adrian, before we find out who the winner is, what's the correct answer?
Oh, well, the correct answer is Kawasaki Frontale.
And we have one lucky winner. Adrian, could you please tell us who our winner is?
Congratulations to Luke Francis. And we will be in contact with you, Luke. And congratulations and enjoy your bump from Art of Football.
Indeed. Thanks very much indeed to Art of Football for putting up that prize. Fantastic.
Meanwhile, on the evening of Sunday, May the 21st, BT Sport will be recording an episode of The Football's On, bringing together some of the UK's top comedy talent to talk about their football passions at The Forge, a five-minute walk from Brighton Station. It's on the corner of Cheapside and Blackman Street, and in fact, just where Radio Reverb used to be. Host Ian Stone will be joined by the very funny Adam Rowe, Nathan Caton, and our very own Stephen Grant. Doors are open at 5:30, straight after the home game with Southampton, with the show starting at 7 o'clock. Now, the Forge Comedy Club has teamed up with the Albion Roar for a superb offer. Tickets for this event are normally a fiver each. However, if you go to www.forgecomedyclub.co.uk and on the homepage click on the Football's On link, when you click on Buy Tickets, simply enter BHAFC into the discount code field to reduce your ticket to just £2. Yep, it's reduced from a fiver to a couple of quid. Booking fees still applies. And we hope to see you there.
Have we got to talk about what I really hope we need to talk about now?
Right.
Really?
Did anything happen on Monday, Matt? I think I might have been washing my hair.
Yeah. No, football was all off on Monday, wasn't it?
Yeah, nothing. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. Should we go to the pub?
Yeah, too right. You've been listening to the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb. Matt, you've watched us this season. We are kind of far too emotionally involved in this. So if you can do this with a little bit of a wiser, clearer head, what on earth happened?
It looked like a team that perhaps it was one game too far, and Everton turned up with a game plan and executed it very well, got in front even further, and then just defended
even further.
Defended for their lives. Very unexpected performance, probably from both sides, really. Very unexpected outcome. Impressed with the way Everton defended second half when Albion were threatening to get back in it and really sort of come back and try and get something out of it. But just sometimes you throw in one of these bad days, especially towards the end of the season, don't you? It's not unknown for these sort of things to happen. The sight of De Zerbi making four subs at half time, you know, is I wonder if he could have made 11 if he'd been able to, you know. I'm sure he would have done that, but yeah, just a very bad day for Brighton. The sort of thing you feel, especially with De Zerbi in charge, isn't going to be repeated, and it was just too far to come back, wasn't it?
Well, that's just it. I mean, we were talking earlier in the week, weren't we? I mean, it's like this only becomes a bad performance if it is more than a blip.
Well, quite. It's something I remember Paul Ince saying when he was manager of Blackpool. We turned them over 6-1, and we had the good grace actually to score all 7 goals. there's not a huge amount as a manager you can say when you get stuff like that. But he did point out that if it was happening week in, week out, you know, he'd be concerned, and rightly so. But it's not. It's a freak occurrence, certainly since De Zerbi took over. I don't think we suffered that badly even under Potter. I could be wrong. We might have had a nasty reversal. But let's put it this way. I think the shock for most people is that, you know, you can see just through being an Albion fan for so long that we turn over Manchester United, we lose to Everton. You're kind of expecting it. We are governed by the law according to sod. It happened. This is the way the cookie crumbles. This is the way the custard turns. This is, all right, another food metaphor, if you so wish. This is what it's like to support Brighton and Hove Albion. And every other fan of every other club will say, have their sod's law argument as well. Fine. What we didn't see coming was such a hiding, it wasn't even a poor performance per se. On the ball, fine. It's just that it's an example of the risk and reward. When it works, when you see it in operation, it can be wonderful. But when it goes wrong, it goes sorely wrong.
Yeah.
I've got to say this. As much as we're all hurting and we're all smarting and we've lost a little bit of faith, and we're all thinking, are we going to achieve our goal? Can we do it? Blah, blah, blah. One, the players are smarting a damn sight more than the fans are. Two, the management are smarting even more than the players. Even if people are more than willing to blame De Zerbi for not getting his tactics right, I think Matt's point is very, very pertinent. It looked a game too far. The players looked kind of out on their feet. But in the great scheme of things, if the team wanted a wake-up call, I would rather a 5-1 stuffing than a moody 1-0 defeat, because a 5-1 really gives you a kick up the backside. You'd like to think that they don't need it, but now they've had this public humiliation of a 5-1 defeat at home to a relegation-threatened side who might be playing Plymouth Argyle next season. Yeah. Everyone has just, you know, had a 240-volt shot put through them. And if they can respond, which I think probably against every piece of adversity so far this season, they've shown they can and have and will, I think we'll be okay for the rest of the season. It's just we have to lick our wounds as fans, because we see it as a slight humiliation. We were done. We were turned over. We were stuffed by the better side. But that's football.
Yeah. Matt?
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. I think just occasionally you come up against a team like Everton and they're horrible to play against as well, aren't they? You know, they're
Villa are like that.
Yeah, and I think Villa have done the double over Albion this season as well? So that sort of
We've only played them once, so that would be an easy trick.
Yeah, but they keep beating us.
But you know, you look at it, Albion had all the play second half. They get a goal back. But it was too much of a mountain to climb in the end. But the way Everton defended was so good, and the way Pickford performed was so good that they managed to stave off, you know, a 4-4 draw potentially at the end.
Well, this is it, Matt. Because I mean, at half time, we're out in the concourse at half time having a chat, and we were 3-0 down at the time, and I think to a man, a lot of people thought that this gig wasn't up. Yeah. It was. We thought, well, we can come back from this. I mean, the third goal might have been the one that possibly pushed it over there for a few. But, you know, I have faith that we could turn it around. And you know what? That second half performance was actually, if you take Pickford out of the equation, was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? And you know, you've got a manager there in De Zerbi who's not going to let this happen again. It's not like this is going to suddenly seep into the consciousness and you're going to go and get spanked again. This is going to be a one-off. It's going to be a lesson learned. He's going to have them in for extra training this week and he's going to work them to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Yeah.
They'll be extra drilled for Arsenal on Sunday. It's not the ideal game to go into on the back of this, but maybe is it? You know, you begin to think maybe perhaps this is, you know, going to the Emirates is perhaps the game you want now.
Well, let's put it this way. I think we play against... we in recent history, we played better against teams who give us that little bit of space, who want to come out. Arsenal are at home. They'll give us that bit of space. Well, they won't give us the space. There will be space. Let's face it, Everton defended very deep, very solidly, and was a difficult line to break down. I take your point, AD, about the half-time thing, that it was horrible. We've 4-0, too much. And this is where probably Wolves fans gave up on it straight away. But 3-0, you think, well, if we can actually then play how we can do, get an early goal, let's test Everton's resolve. Let's see what happens. But, and I think this is it, if we'd have got that early goal, you know, the doubt creeps in. It's a bit like when we went 3-0 up against Chelsea and they scored in the first minute of the second half and we're going, you know, can we keep hold of this? In the end, we did and went up the end and scored a last minute fourth. Great. But if we'd have got one and then on 60 minutes we get a second, this is then a major test of Everton's mentality. But it's all about the fact that, yes, we had those chances and we were either profligate or Pickford was in very, very good form, both as a proper goalkeeper and in terms of his outhousery.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about Jordan Pickford a little bit. I mean, obviously, Matt, he is currently England's goalkeeper. I mean, there are a few pretenders to the crown now. I mean, with Nick Pope and...
Ramsdale
at Arsenal. I mean, he's got a fight in his hands to keep his shirt. And you know, performances like that are only going to help him do that, aren't they? I mean, I haven't seen a goalkeeping display like that since Nick Pope against us earlier in the season. Actually, think about it.
Well, I mean, first of all, Gareth Southgate's a very loyal manager, isn't he? And he's stayed loyal to Pickford in some of his darkest moments.
Oh,
goodness. Very loyal. Very loyal. I'm on the right podcast for this. I'm preaching to the converted here.
Hashtag McGuire, yes.
So, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's just got to underline for him that Pickford's his number one. Ramsdale and Pope have been very good as well. But you know, Pickford has the gloves, doesn't he, for England for as long as he wants them, until he really screws it up at some point or walks away under Southgate, because he's, you know, he's been his number one throughout, through thick and lots of thin.
Has Steele improved enough for him to be on the periphery yet?
Oof, that's an interesting one, isn't it? You'll have seen more of him than I have, but I've been very impressed by the games I have seen him in recently, for sure. I mean,
Monday's own goal notwithstanding.
Yeah, I actually think Sanchez has got more chance, and he plays for Spain. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, could you imagine?
You have to acknowledge. I mean, the interview that Jason Steele did about 2 weeks ago, where acknowledging when he was on Sunderland till I die. I mean, you know, the Sunderland fans absolutely despised him. They thought he was absolutely hopeless. I mean, for point of reference, we're talking Wayne Henderson, Graham Smith here from our point of view.
Mm.
He was not liked. Came here.
Wayne Henderson.
You know, he spent a lot of time in the Stiffs, and Ben Roberts happened to him. and he has stuck by us. All right, he spent a lot of time at our club, not playing for the first team, but finally he's forced his way in. De Zerbi fancies him more as a distributing goalkeeper, you know, with what he expects a team who bosses possession, he expects all 11 to do, as well as being a good shot stopper. But I suspect that probably the fact that he's actually playing in a good team, the way he does, is against what Southgate does. I mean, you know, it's not as though he expects his goalkeeper to lump it every time, but what De Zerbi wants of his goalkeeper and what Southgate wants of his goalkeeper aren't necessarily one and the same. Yeah.
But I think that was why Pickford got the shirt in the first place, because of his ability with the ball at his feet, wasn't it?
Well, in that case, then Jason Steele really is possibly further up the pecking order than we'd realise, if that was one of the criteria.
I mean, again, it was one of the few criticisms against Pope as well, that he's just he's a fantastic goalkeeper in the traditional sense of actually stopping the ball going in the back of the net, but in terms of the modern way being an extra outfield player, he's just not good enough to do that.
Matt, from what you've seen this season, like you say, it might be slightly limited, but you reckon you haven't seen too many dropsies from Jason Steele this season?
I've obviously missed his biggest bloopers, obviously, but be fairly impressed. He's a great survivor, isn't he, Jason Steele, really? You know, every sort of club seems to have one, and he seems to be Brighton's. You know, you look at certain players who have somehow kept going and got through and been loaned out or been out of favour or dropped down to third, fourth choice. You know, Steele's sort of been there through lots of various things, and now he's playing regular Premier League football, which I don't think many of us could have predicted at this stage in his Brighton career. So, fair play to him for that.
I think there's someone who did. AD? No, what's it wasn't that? You. It was Phil.
What?
Predicted. Well, do you remember his pre-season prediction was Robert Sanchez will lose the shirt?
It was, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I think we're all doing really well apart from you so far, aren't we?
Well, to be fair, mine was taken away from me. What we're talking about here, dear listener, is that at the very beginning of the season, there was AD, myself, Andy Bass, Marcus Hancocks and Phil Shelley. We made our pre-season predictions as to who we thought was going to be top scorer, who was going to be the player of the season, plus a random quirky fact about someone.
A wild card.
Now, we're not going to discuss what all those predictions were. We will do that on the last show of the season. But suffice to say that the other four, apart from me, their predictions are scarily accurate. I'm going to tell you what mine was, but that's because it was taken away from me. And mine was that Enoch Wepu was going to get the most red cards. And but for the Albion physio, it had probably got a permanent red card. So, yeah, my mine had it fell by the wayside a long time ago. But the other four, which you'll find out probably towards in about 3 or 4 weeks' time, are scarily accurate. And yes, and AD is looking seriously smug right now.
Well, to be honest, it wasn't too much of a stretch, to be honest. So
no, but it was enough to say, you know. Marcus's one was shouldn't have been a stretch and hasn't been. Andy's one got laughed out of the room and is 100% correct. You will find these out in about 3 or 4 weeks' time.
I think you'll find out that Andy's got laughed out of the room because he's come up with the same one for the last 5 years and got it horribly wrong.
Yeah, well, a stop clock is right twice a day, isn't it?
Like
I say, this is did the players need a wake up call? I don't think so. The confidence was high. I hope it doesn't shake their confidence. The result. But then the likes of you and I and everyone else, because we're not there at Lancing day in, day out, we don't get to see the things that the players do that put things right. De Zerbi knew, because, I mean, what's De Zerbi said after the game, I think, concerned some people because they felt he was deflecting. Okay. I don't care the fact he was deflecting. He knows what went wrong. Yeah.
All right, Al. Then a question. Then what do you think is more damaging? Is it losing to Everton or losing Solly March for possibly the rest of the season?
Everton is one match. Solly is for another six. So there's your answer. In as much as his ready-made replacement, the one who's been starting ahead of him, He's done okay to start with, considering he's only been with the squad for about 3 months. He's only 18. He's got a lot to learn. He's doing okay for the person he is. But when Solly March does come on, you get to realise, A, what a player, superior player he is, and B, what an asset he is to the squad and the team. Solly March, I don't think he's going to get player of the season, but I think for a lot of people, he's going to be in their top three. And so, for the, assume that we have lost him for the last six games, yeah, a big miss.
Yeah, I mean, there's not been any reports on that as yet, Matt. I'm sure we'll find out as we get closer to the weekend. But it did look bad.
Well, yeah, a torn hamstring is no fun at all. Matt, do you go to the pressers?
Yeah, I do occasionally, not all the time. I remember going to a string of them during lockdown on Zoom. It's bringing back memories doing this on fact and the Potter press. But I mean, they're a bit livelier with De Zerbi, aren't they?
I don't know, are they? You're there in the room. We get to hear what he says, and of course he's still struggling with his English, and he still has his interpreter next to him helping him. But what's the atmosphere? Well, give us a flavour of the atmosphere of what it's like to talk to Potter versus what it's like to talk to Roberto.
I think you probably couldn't find two more different characters in terms of their charisma and the outgoing effect they give you as a manager, I would say. I think Potter is sort of renowned for being a manager who doesn't like to lay into his players, isn't he? You can imagine after the 5-1 defeat on Monday, what Tuesday was like at training at Lancing, for instance, if he's got the players in, if he's got the players in for extra training, and putting them through their paces to get that out of the system. That would have been very different under Potter. They'd have spoken about what happened and why and, you know, how we can't let this happen again. You imagine De Zerbi would have been straight in with, right, guys, this doesn't happen again. You did this, you did that, you did this. As a team, we can't do this. And completely almost knocked that defeat out of them. It's two such different approaches from managers you can't imagine, really. So, yeah, I think the players will absolutely know that this can't happen again. And when you're playing for a manager like that, you've got no choice. You're not going to get back in the side if you're playing like that. If you're part of a disaster, like if you've come off at half time on Monday night, for instance, it's a very clear warning, a very clear message to you from the manager, isn't it? You know, that this can't happen again.
Yeah. What I'm actually kind of was more alluding to, but I take your point completely about that, was what's the atmosphere like in the pressers with Potter versus De Zerbi?
Yeah. Well, I would say, the Potter pressers were mostly conducted on Zoom. So it was quite a, you know, for a lot of the time it was on Zoom for 2 years in the pandemic. So it was a very different sort of kettle of fish. And it was, you know, you speak to guys who cover Chelsea this season and things like that as well. That, you know, Potter's a different guy. It's a completely different beast. And De Zerbi sort of fills the room with just much more sort of charisma, really. And they, effect you get is that, you know, you want to play for this guy, even sitting there as a journalist. You want to run through brick walls for this guy, which you hear about managers sometimes. And I think just the Potter effect is just a very different one, a very subtle, much more subdued approach. And so, two very different pressers, I would say.
Do you also feel like you have to kind of sit to attention with him?
I think a little bit. Whereas Potter, you're just having a conversation with a guy about football, I guess.
It's funny you should say though, Matt. I mean, you're talking about Roberto getting the players in this week and drilling to make sure that the aberration that happened on Monday doesn't happen again. But I can't. But you also said that Monday was a game too far. So I kind of think that, particularly with the fact that there are some heavy legs in that squad at the moment, and the fact that they are so well drilled in what he wants, I suspect that it's not going to be as hard a week as you could possibly imagine. I think that he's going to want to, like, you know, he'll have seen what happened to Solly, and he's like, well, we can't risk that happen to anybody else. Matt?
I just wonder if it's going to be more of a getting the players to get, rather than perhaps necessarily putting them through running up hills and a complete sort of punishment week. It's almost more of a
go bowling
them in the meeting. Sorry,
go bowling.
It's almost more of a meeting room thing, I think, where a manager like that's going to drill home his point to you. It's not necessarily going to make you train more or what have you. But, you know, this guy's going to get his point across and he's not going to be asking for a discussion. He's going to be telling you what you've done wrong and what needs to change. And I think that's probably changing the mindset ahead of the visit to Arsenal.
I can't remember who the club was, but I mean, I know the Elbin used to go bowling occasionally as a team building. Was it Sunderland?
Was it Sheffield Big Wednesday?
It could have been, but they went out. They took the team bowling for a team building exercise, and one of the players dropped a ball on his foot and was out for the rest of the season.
Right. So, with all that as well, Matt, I mean, do you get the feeling? Because you know, there's De Zerbi is head coach. But do you get an inkling as to whether he's also a good person manager? You know, he knows when to use the carrot. He knows when to use the stick. Do you get that feeling from him?
I do. I think there are different ways of doing it. And again, Potter and De Zerbi are so, so different as kind of, you know, successive Albion managers. So two completely different ways of doing it. But yeah, I think De Zerbi is. I think he knows how to handle his players. I think he's just... You see one side of him at the games, don't you? He's a very animated guy. I think once the dust settled, he'll know exactly what he wants to get out of the players and exactly how to get that from them. And that must have been something that Albion had seen in him to want to appoint him in the first place. This guy's not a complete hothead, that he knows how to do it both ways. So, I do see a good man manager there. And I guess the proof will be in the pudding. Sort of on Sunday to an extent.
Yeah. The problem is, Matt, with these managers that have got big charisma and certainly in De Zerbi's space, big potential. I mean, they're commodities that clubs are attracted to. And, you know, we already know that there's a lot of Italian clubs that are interested in that may possibly turn his head. But I also get the impression that, you know, he knows he's part of something special here. And why would you want to leave now?
Well, that's it, isn't it? And he's, you know, desperate to get European football, isn't he, as well? So, you know, he's completely focused on that, doesn't want anything to derail it. So he will have been fuming the other day. He will have put that right this week, I'm sure, and feel that he's got everything sorted to go to Arsenal and win.
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, let's just go back to the Everton game quickly before we move on. Because... I mean, I must admit, I was in a bit of a funk after the game, and I didn't actually realise just how brilliant McAllister's goal was. It's as good as the goal of the season that got disallowed.
Okay, bear in mind I've not seen it since, and don't use the word aplomb. What happened? Did it go in off his backside or something?
Alexis shot. Carew got in on the loose ball, which bounced off the keeper and hit Alexis on the head and went in.
They all count.
It was
from below sea level.
It was a 6-inch screamer.
Right. Was it in the Calderon scores with his face mould?
No, it just hit him on the back of the head and went in.
Well, do you know what? You know, if that's the difference between... If that's the one goal that gets us into Europe by goal difference, then I'll buy it all day long.
Yeah. But it was absolutely genius. That is all we've got time for. Hopefully, we're going to be talking about some more glamorous goals in the Albion account when we speak to you next week. But in the interim, thank you so much to Alan West. Thank you to Matthew Nash. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, of course, on our podcast, and in association with allfootballshirts.com. See you all again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye. Sailing ship to nowhere, leaving any place.
Disgrace.